whatever they said in public, they lived in private. And the passion for the Lord that I saw in my parents, it overflowed into their public ministry, but it began as a private life.
That's popular Christian recording artist Steve Green recalling how he observed a consistency in his parents in their dedication to godly living. This is Focus on the Family, and today Steve and several other well-known Christians will comment on their upbringing, and Gloria Gaither joins us in the studio for a look at what parents can do right as they guide their children through life. And our host will be psychologist Dr. James Dobson, and I'm Mike Trout. Stay tuned as we focus on the family. Doctor?
Mike, so many times in our culture today, you hear people talking about what their parents did wrong. In fact, one of the strategies of the anti-family movement in this society is to imply that a good home is impossible to achieve now. They love to talk about the fact that you can't go back to Ozzie and Harriet. Mm-hmm. And you get the feeling they wouldn't if they could, because there is this opposition to a traditional family life. And so that's just around us. We hear it all the time. I think there are many parents who watch television and listen to these ideas and honestly believe that it is not possible to achieve a good family life today, to live in an environment where people love each other and care for one another and committed to each other for life. And we strongly disagree with that concept, and our program today is designed to say it ain't true.
I agree with you. I think that's one of Satan's great tools today, to say that you can't do it. There's no point in even trying very hard. It's not attainable. It's not possible. And as you said, that just is not accurate.
Well, that's going to be our emphasis today. And here to help us talk about family life and what parents did right is our good friend Gloria Gaither, songwriter, author, teacher, mother of three, and wife of Bill Gaither. Good friends to Shirley and me. Gloria, welcome back to Focus on the Family.
Good to be back, Jim. Good to be with you again.
Why didn't you bring old Bill with you this time? He's usually
here. Bill's down in Branson, Missouri, and doing yet another project. I said, people said, what does Bill do? I said, he starts things.
And finishes a few of them.
Finishes a few.
Yes.
Well, you start some things of your own, including a very popular book called What My Parents Did Wrong. Right. And as I was just emphasizing, this book really describes for about, 50 people that you mm-hmm. interviewed, the things that they feel best about from their early home life. What led you into writing a book of this nature?
Jim, several things. One is my own home. I came from a wonderfully reinforcing, positive home that has given me a head start on life. And somewhere along the way, I somehow felt the pendulum shift from having good, helpful materials for people who have dysfunctional backgrounds to almost a syndrome of parent bashing. If there's anything wrong with me, maybe instead of dealing with it, I can blame my parents. And we had horror story after horror story coming out of celebrities telling what their parents did wrong. And you know, somewhere along the way, I wanted to just kind of lift my hand out of the crowd and say, pardon me, but I think my parents did a few things right. So I, on the hunch that there might be some other people out there who felt the same way, I did write to 50 or 60 outstanding leaders who were impacting the world in positive ways and said, did your parents do anything right? And the response was overwhelming. They said, yes, we're so glad you asked.
What jumps out in your memory from the 50 different responses?
Well, one was Colleen Townsend Evans, who was the child of a single mother. And one of the things she said was that she didn't even notice that she had a single parent family, which was a statistic, I mm-hmm. suppose, until she was grown and looked back and said, my goodness, how did my mother do that? She was so joyful. We had such a good time growing up. And she tells this little story at the very end, where she and her husband and the children went to visit their grandmother. And it was the very last time they saw her before she died. And pulling away from the curb, they looked back in the rearview mirror, and she had her skirt kind of pulled up to her knees, doing this little soft shoe on the curb of the street as she drove away. And she hollered at them as they drove away, hey, not bad, eh? And they said, not bad, Mom. And then they got the news that mm-hmm. she actually had passed away, with this funny little joke lingering in their family's memory, mm-hmm. the last memory. And Collington, as I look back, I know my mother had a really tough time, but I never knew it when it was going on, and even at the last, she was dancing on the curb.
And those were the days when a single mother was an unusual
thing.
In our culture. You know, my very earliest memory of my father, I mean the first memory, I was 2 years of age. I remember it as though it were yesterday. I was home with my mother in the afternoon. My dad was a minister too, as you know, and he'd been at the church. And he came home and he knocked on the front door instead of coming through. And my mother knew what was about to happen, so she let me go to the door. And I opened the door, and my dad was standing there, and he said, "Come with me." And he took me by the hand, and we went around to the side of the house, and there was a big blue tricycle sitting there, brand new. I mean, this tricycle looked like it was about 10 feet tall to me. And that's my very earliest memory of my dad.
Surprises.
Did it have a siren on it? I had one of those that, you know, you lowered the siren to the front wheel, and the faster you went, siren was
louder. You were a little more opulent than we were. My dad did well to buy a tricycle, an ordinary tricycle.
This was given to us.
Gloria, you did grow up in a very loving home, didn't you?
I did.
You never rebelled against your parents.
No, and Jim, I grew up in the 60s when that was the thing. You know, I guess the first time I asked myself what did my parents do right was when I went to college and I got to be a sophomore in the 60s. And I realized that if I was going to be considered an intellect, I should be rebelling, hating my parents, kicking over the traces, despising my siblings. And I thought, if I'm going to be considered an intellect, I better keep my mouth shut, because I loved my family, couldn't wait to go home, and my sister was my best friend. That was probably the first time that I remember consciously saying to myself, why don't I feel this way? What did my parents do? I want to repeat. I want my children to love to come
home. Can you put that into a 60-second statement? Why did you not rebel against your parents?
I think one thing was a real feeling of openness in our home. They made me feel that there was no question I couldn't ask. There was no doubt that I could make God go away. So I never felt closed off, no matter what I did. And I never felt maybe a reason to rebel. I don't remember having a curfew, for instance, in my home, because there was this tremendous sense of responsibility we had for each other. And I remember when I was on dates or when I was in compromising situations, thinking to myself, we have an incredible trust at home. This is just not worth it. And it was my parents' confidence in me. They would always say to me and to other people, I know you have such good judgment. We can trust you. And when I was in situations where I might not have had good judgment, I would always say, boy, I don't want to ruin that.
Yeah,
it's
I felt that same thing.
It's not worth it.
I know exactly what you mean. Gloria, we have taken, six clips from the video that you have now done of some of those respondents.
I think there are five. Gloria, you've got the list of the names there.
Who are we going to hear from here?
Well, one is Bill Gaither. I think that's a really good choice, and I'm very thankful for his parents for doing a few things right. Chuck Colson, Larnell Harris, and Steve Green. And Jim, somebody you know very well, Danae Dobson.
That's right.
Danae, and I can't wait to hear what she has.
Was one of the people that participated. And Mike, let's hear some of these clips to give people a flavor of what's in the book.
Okay, we put a little music behind them, and we'll just air them back to back.
I don't know whether we came from across the tracks or on the right side of the tracks or not. We just came from a working home. And I never had the feeling that my parents were somebody special or big or important, but I never had the feeling that we were nobodies either. I just had a good feeling that we were somebodies, that we were somebody that mattered in the eyes of God. And because of that, then I could function when I did experience failure on the outside, when I wasn't chosen for the ball team. I was not included in a circle of friends, which is very important to a young kid. No matter how bad it got out there, when I came back home, it was good, and it was going to be fun, it was going to be a warm meal. And it's interesting in that most of my grade school life, my father worked on the second shift. So when I came home from school, he wasn't even there. And I still didn't feel like I was abandoned, because we knew that by 11:30, 12 o'clock, he would be home and in bed and be there in the morning and be there on the weekends. And we still made it in spite of that. And then in the summer, of course, we were working during the day on the farm. So, and I don't mean to be overrating it, but it's a pretty fantastic place.
Do whatever you do with excellence. My dad, who was not a very devout person, I think he was very devout in his own inner beliefs, but he wasn't overtly evangelical and wasn't a regular churchgoer. But he was reflecting to me that the Protestant work ethic at its very best. And he would say, whatever you do, it doesn't matter whether you're cleaning toilets or whether you're president of the United States, do the best you can. The great irony is that that was one of those things that stayed with me. I always thought all through school and every work I ever had, do the best you can. And when I was in the Marines, I ended up one day cleaning toilets. When I went to prison, I ended up cleaning toilets. And then, of course, I was in the office next to the President of the United States. So what my dad said in jest when I was a child came home to roost when I was an adult. I ended up having to do my best cleaning toilets and to do my best serving a President of the United States.
My mom called me on the phone and said, I want you to come and go to the doctor with your father. Now, that's a little switch. And so I got in the car. I live in Louisville, Kentucky, and I drove to Danville, where they were residing, and took him to the hospital. He was being asked to do something in the maintenance of his own health that he didn't feel he could do. In fact, this procedure that the doctors were suggesting that would help him, he figured if he had to do that, then life was over. He could not. That was not something he could do. He was not capable of doing that. And so we did go to the doctor, and the doctor had the nurse do a little demonstration on him, and then did the demonstration and had him do it. And in short, he found out that this was not all that big a deal, and that he could indeed do it. And when I saw that, what sounds like a very unimportant event was all too important, because I literally saw life come back into his eyes, because it was like, oh, yeah. And I went home and I wrote a song. Got with a good friend of mine in Nashville, David Clark, and we wrote a lyric called I Can Begin Again. It was the number one song in the country. And the chorus of that song says, I can begin again with the passion of a child. For my heart has caught a vision of a life that's still worthwhile. I can reach out again far beyond what I've done, like a dreamer who's awakened to a life that's yet to come, because new beginnings are not just for the young.
My oldest sister was married, and all of us were at the wedding. And shortly after that, the rest of the family moved back to South America. And we waited anxiously for the wedding pictures to arrive. And when they did arrive, they were in a box, but it was not labeled correctly. And in fact, I think there were some other things in there. And my father knew that and allowed the customs official to believe that they were just photographs. But after just a brief time, I don't know how long it was, but I remember distinctly him gathering us around and telling us that he felt that he had deceived this customs official, and that he had to go back and ask forgiveness and tell him exactly what had been in that package. And so he boxed them back up and took them down, and when he brought them back and we had them framed and put up on the wall, they weren't just wedding pictures any longer to me. They were reminders of the value of a clear conscience.
When I was 4 years old, my dad and I used to go on bike rides quite often. And there was one Sunday afternoon, I had come back from church and I was all in my dress-up clothes, my shoes and my dress and everything. And my mom told me I was gonna have to take a nap. And you know, most kids at that age are not interested in going to sleep at any hour, even at night. But I decided that I was gonna have to do what they told me to do. So I went in and I got into my clothes, and my dad came in and he said, why don't we go for a bike ride? And I just remember I was so excited to have a chance to go out and do something other than sleep. So he had just bought a little bicycle seat the day before to put on the back of his bike. So we went out to the garage and he got out his bike and he put the little seat on the back, but unfortunately he had put the seat a little too forward. So he put me on the seat and we pedaled down the street and rode off into the wind, and all of a sudden my foot got stuck into the spoke of the bicycle, and you can imagine what happened next. We both flew over the handlebars and crashed, and I can just remember I was really hurt and I was frightened, but what I remember more was the way my dad reacted to the situation. He just picked me up and he ran and carried me all the way back to the house, and I really think he felt worse about the situation than I did even. And the way that he reacted was what I remember even more than the pain and the frightening experience.
Oh, those are wonderful remembrances, and they probably triggered a lot of thoughts in your mind, those of you who are listening today. Doctor, do you remember that bicycle sequence?
Oh, that was one of the worst days of my life, literally. Danae has forgotten. She remembers the seat on the back of the bike, but it was actually on the bar in front of me. And
sounds like it was down by the spokes where you put the thing.
It eventually was, because the whole bike locked on her foot, and we were going 20 miles an hour. We'd come down the driveway and onto the street, and I was really pumping, and that entire bike, the weight of the two of us and that bike, locked on her little foot and just chewed it. It threw her into the pavement and knocked her tooth loose and just scratched her face up. I thought I was going to die. I mean, I picked that kid up. I left the bike in the middle of the road, and I ran down the road. We were both crying. She was howling, and I was crying, and I was saying, "I'm sorry, babe. I'm sorry," because I had done it to her. But, you know, she was only 2 or 3 years of age, mm-hmm. and yet she remembers that mm-hmm. fondly, of all things. That's one of the warmer memories of her childhood, because of the way I responded to her.
Because you treasured her, and she knew that she was more valuable.
And every child now knows why they were told, don't ride your bike without your shoes on.
That didn't help. Fortunately, the foot was not broken, and it quickly healed up, mm-hmm. and the tooth got knocked around 4 or 5 more times before it finally fell out. So
it's really interesting what children remember, and I'd like to say this in encouragement to parents listening. I think sometimes parents think the big things, you know, they didn't have enough money, or they didn't have the right opportunity, or the kid couldn't wear Nikes or Izods or whatever. The child remembers little times when they were treasured. I guess if I had advice for parents, it'd be just loosen up, enjoy it, have fun.
Yeah, and make your kids a priority. We've mm-hmm. gotten away from that. Our priorities are our jobs. Our priorities are the pressures that we're under and the adult responsibilities. Mm-hmm. All of that's going to fade. It's going to burn. You know,
absolutely.
What will be remembered are those little experiences in the home, those routine things. I remember Howard Hendricks saying that when he asked his children what they remember most fondly from their childhood, it was not the trips to Disneyland. It was not the expensive vacations that they took and all this stuff that he thought they would recall. It was when he would come home from work and get on his hands and knees on the floor and wrestle and fight with those kids. That was their greatest memory of childhood. But it takes time to do that. Gloria, we have a wonderful way of concluding this discussion today. You and Bill were apparently in your living room. We have an audio tape that I think came from a videotape of Bill singing a song that you all have written called We'll Be There. And you kind of set it up, and then Bill just played at the piano and sang. And he made a couple of mistakes, and that's all right. It's just sort of a in-your-home informal song that the two of you were sharing. Can you tell us anything else about it? Describe the song particularly.
Actually, the performance of it was sort of an accident, but someone asked us if we had ever written anything about commitment of families, and this came to mind, and so we just dug it in. It basically starts at the time a child is born. We'll be there when you first sleep through the night, and it goes all the way till the child leaves, and you have to say, you know, we'll be there when you're out on your own, and you hope you'll feel like you can still come home. Bring your kids.
Let's hear it, Mike.
One thing that Bill and I can both say about our families is that they were just there. They were always there for us. When people have a new baby, it's always fun to have a new baby. But you sign up for the duration. You sign up for the skin knees, and you sign up for the teenage years, and you sign up for college tuition, and you sign up for the little bride that walks down the aisle, and you sign up for the kid who goes off to service, and you sign up for them coming back home, and you sign up for them leaving again and making homes of their own, and you sign up for their kids. And our parents both signed up, and we're very grateful for that. And maybe that's why we were so ready to sign up for our kids. We wrote a song about it.
We'll be there when you sleep through the night.
Finally.
We'll be there when you need us to hold you tight. And for the first step you take and the first time you make it clear to the top of the stairs. When you wish on a star, when you learn who you are, we'll be there. And we'll be there when your words turn to rhyme. We'll be there, read your stories at bedtime. When you play in the park and you're scared of the dark, when you learn how to pray your first prayer. Through the thunder and storm, when it's cold or it's warm, we'll be there. And we'll be there. When you skin up your knees, thanks. We'll be there. When you climb to the top of the trees. So old dad, he's gonna teach you to hike and ride a two-wheel bike. Build a kite that will soar through the air. When you wade through the streams, when you dream your first dreams, we'll be there. And we'll be there when you try out your wings. Oh, Mom and Dad will be there, all right, when you're questioning everything. When you learn how to choose and you win, sometimes you lose. And you find that the world is unfair. When you stand or you fall, you can know through it all. We'll be there. And we'll be there. When you think.
You hope.
When you hope that you're all alone. Oh, we'll be there all right. Probably waiting to use the phone. And when you're out on a date and you get home too late and you quietly slip up the stairs, though you might never guess,
we're awake.
We're awake and we won't rest until you're there. And we'll be there when you're out on your own. And we'll be there, so proud of the way that you've grown. Thanking God every day that He sent you our way. And He trusted you once to our care. And wherever you roam, you can always come home. We'll be there.
Gloria, that song is so meaningful all the way through, but what particularly speaks to me is that you're saying to your children, we're committed to each other, and after you're gone, we're still going to be here. That you can bring your children to see their grandparents. We're going to be here together in marriage. That is a lifetime commitment. That's inspired stuff.
In fact, I just built a front porch in my house. I figured if those grandkids are going to be running down the hillside, I'm going to have a porch I can watch.
That's great.
Gloria, I really appreciate you coming to be here today to talk about your book.
Thank
and
you,
the
Jim.
Concept of it. I appreciate your friendship. Give a hug to Bill when you go home. Will
I
you?
Sure will.
Today's program, Doctor, is one of those that I just like to rewind and listen to again. There's so much here for me as a parent to learn. This is Focus on the Family. We appreciate you joining us for today's broadcast as we've reviewed some of the right things that parents have done, and hopefully we've offered you some direction as well.
This broadcast is provided by Focus on the Family. Thanks go to our audio engineer, Kurt Morse, and our producer, John Fuller. Our host has been psychologist and best-selling author, Dr. James Dobson. And I'm Mike Trout, inviting you back when we'll again turn our hearts toward home.